a panda walks into a bar, which sounds like the great start to a joke, but it's a visual joke. That's the realm in which today's guest works. Cartoonist Dan Peraro joins us today prior to a free appearance on Sunday at 2 at the downtown Eugene Public Library. Dan Peraro is a man of many talents, but he's best known for the bizarro single-panel comic, seen in somewhere north of 350 newspapers every day, as well as online. Dan has won awards several times over for his work on Bizarro, which is somewhat hard to categorize. As his own web bio puts it, if Salvador Dali, Gary Trudeau, and Oscar Wilde had an illegitimate child, that child would be Dan Peraro. Dan Peraro, welcome to The Exchange. Good to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you. That introduction, that last line about the Oscar Wilde always makes me laugh.
Was that your own creation?
Oh, no. Somebody else wrote that. I'm not sure who. That's why it gives me a giggle, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting timing that you're going to be in Eugene on Sunday because there was just some real recent news out of there about cartoonist Jan Elliott, who is the creator of the Stone Soup strip that runs in a lot of papers in the region.
Right.
Announced that she's going to stop doing daily strips after 15 years. And she describes it as a bit of a grind. And I can imagine after 30, you can certainly relate.
Yeah, it is. That's the thing is that the people don't realize it's an enviable job and it's a difficult one to get and one that a lot of people want. And so I'm fully appreciative of all that. But it's more difficult, I think, than people imagine. Certainly more difficult than I imagined it would be in the sense that when you're syndicated in newspapers, you have to provide new content 365 days a year for as long as you want that job. So there is no built-in vacation. You're not allowed reruns, and you can't call in sick. And it's quite often very challenging to keep up that kind of a pace. There have been in recent years a few syndication companies that have offered. They have allowed their creators, is what they call cartoonists, oddly enough. But they've allowed their cartoonists, their creators, to take some time off each year and run reruns. But the problem is it's a very competitive newspaper industry these days, especially as newspapers are going out of business. So they tend not to want to run reruns. If you offer them reruns for 2 weeks while you take time off, they'll more than likely put a new feature in there, and you could lose that spot permanently. So most people just don't do it. It's not seen as being safe. So, 30 years of grinding out a joke a day, no matter what's going on in your personal life, is very challenging.
So it's 30 years just with Bizarro, but how much, did you do much cartooning before that time? I mean, just in the sort of the proto-pre-Bizarros?
No, I really didn't. I was in my 20s just trying to discover myself, find some niche for myself in this capitalist society, try to find a way to make a living that didn't include standing behind a counter in a uniform of some kind. I was in my 20s and working as a commercial illustrator because I could draw well. I always just figured that, somewhere in the world of commercial art, I'd be able to find a living. And so that's what I was doing, was just drawing kind of really low-end, I was drawing pictures of food, things that were going on coupons in the newspaper, that kind of thing. You wouldn't believe how many bags of snack chips I've drawn in my life in my early years. And I got the idea to try cartooning while working. I was actually working at an ad agency for a little while, and I would draw cartoons just to entertain myself. And my coworkers enjoyed the stuff I was doing and encouraged me to try to get them published. And I thought, well, nobody's going to publish this weird stuff. And then somebody showed me a picture, somebody tore a Far Side cartoon out of the newspaper and brought it in to work and said, look, people do publish weird stuff these days in the newspapers. And I was like, wow, I really thought the strangest cartoons I would ever see in the newspaper would be Dennis the Menace and Marmaduke. So I just wrote it off. But then when I saw the Far Side in there, I thought, oh, wow, somebody is doing this now. They're actually putting, because previously that had only been magazine cartoons. That was the only place you could find.
It's true. That's a New Yorker kind of style. Humor. Yeah.
Yeah. It was the only time you could find that kind of humor was in magazines. And back then, all the way up until the late 80s, almost all magazines were full of cartoons, just single panel cartoons thrown about the magazine haphazardly, the way they do in New Yorker now. And I'm not sure why they all stopped doing it, probably just to save money, replace that cartoon with an ad. Why not? That's the way we do things in this country. But But back then, all magazines were just full of cartoons, and those were the kinds that I liked. And I didn't realize they were putting it in the newspaper, and I didn't have the gumption to constantly submit to magazines. That's a very hard life, trying to submit to magazines and submit and submit. And you never have a contract. You never have any kind of stability. It's just who's going to buy what, when, and how long to your next paycheck. Believe me, I know guys in that industry. That's no way to make a living. But the syndication thing sounded appealing because I thought, oh, well, there's probably just tons of money in it, and it's guaranteed, and you can just draw a cartoon a day. And how hard of a job can that be? So I didn't even realize how hard it would be to get the job. You know, I mean, I looked at a few newspaper cartoons back then in the paper, and I saw, gosh, some of these cartoons are good, but some of them are just terrible. This must not be a difficult job to get. I was completely wrong. It was a very difficult job to get. It's like trying to get a record contract for your band or something. It's there's a lot of people trying. And you gotta be good and lucky, and sometimes just lucky.
And here you are, good and lucky, and still hanging on after 30 years. Dan Ferraro is the creator of the Bizarro comic, which is, I keep trying to call it a strip, but it's actually a single panel operation. He'll be in Eugene at the Banned Books Week celebration Sunday at 2:00 at the downtown Eugene Public Library. We'll come back and talk more with Dan and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join the conversation. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dan Ferraro, the cartoonist. He's the creator of the Bizarro comic that appears in more than 350 newspapers across the country every single day for 30 years. He's still at it, still coming up with fresh and funny stuff and things that make you scratch your head or go, ew, what was he meaning there? Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Dan Ferraro prior to a Eugene appearance at the library, 2:00 on Sunday. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone or to get your comments in by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Dan, you said you either got to be lucky or good, but mostly lucky. But so after a while, you actually tried to get through Gary Larson's syndicate. You were kind of following in his footsteps in the slightly offbeat comic, but it was not an instant thing, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's, when I first started sending stuff off to the syndicates, The Far Side had only really just begun. It had been out a couple, 3 years, and it hadn't really caught on big with newspaper editors yet. It wasn't ubiquitous yet the way it eventually became. It was in virtually every newspaper in the country. But at first it was in just a small handful. And so the syndication companies, the people that place these things and sell cartoons to newspapers, that kind of humor wasn't quite on their radar yet. So I got some nice rejection letters from various syndicates when I first started trying to submit. But the people that syndicated The Far Side actually called me on the phone. And they were the only ones, I think, who at the time who really saw the potential of what had previously been magazine-style cartoons in the newspaper. So they called and said, you know, we're a very small syndicate and we're just getting The Far Side off the ground and we're still not entirely sure how well it's going to work. So we don't have the sales force it would take to try to launch another feature in a similar vein or similar category. So, but we would love to stay in contact with you. We'd like you to keep drawing cartoons and sending them to us and just like, you know, kind of develop. They just sort of wanted to develop an editorial relationship with me. In case the Far Side took off and they felt like there was room for another feature like mine. Well, what ended up happening after Larson had been with them for 5 years, which was the length of his first contract, the feature did, in fact, start becoming popular and selling to more newspapers. But because his contract was up, he jumped to a larger syndicate and kind of left them in the lurch. They didn't even realize he was going to do that. It was just all of a sudden, hey, your contract's up. Let's negotiate a new one. He goes, oh, by the way, I just signed with somebody else. And he was gone. So that was fortuitous for me because they then called me up and said, well, They told me that whole story. I said, Larson's gone, and so we'd like to syndicate you and give Bizarro a try. And that was how I got my foot in the door. So it was kind of very lucky. There was no other syndicate that was willing to try me out at that time.
Huh, that is a good story. So, but I realized that doing the multiplication 365 times 30 years, you're closing in on 11,000 cartoons. Is it all a blur to you, or do some stand out? Do you wake up some mornings thinking, boy, I really am glad about that one I did back in 92 or something?
Yeah, well, some of them do stand out. They're never on my mind first thing in the morning, but there are some that a lot of them, you know, for years I could remember virtually every joke, not like off the top of my head, but if somebody said, do you remember this one about that thing? I would go, oh yeah, yeah. And then I would more or less remember the punchline or the basic gag behind it. Right. Well, let's after about 8,000 or 9,000 cartoons, which was a few years ago, that just stopped happening. People would actually send me, nowadays, somebody will send me a JPEG of a cartoon from 89 or something, and I'll look at it and go, wow, I have no recollection of that. I don't remember thinking of it. I don't remember drawing it. It doesn't look familiar, but that is clearly my cartoon with my signature on it and my drawing style. Yep, I did that. but yeah, there are others that stand out in my mind all the time. My very favorite. It's always a mistake to try to explain cartoons on the radio, but I'm going to make that mistake right now. This one's easy. It's two characters. This is my favorite cartoon I've ever written. It just tickles me for some reason. There's two characters standing in the middle of a street in the Middle East, and they're both wearing burqas. Their faces are covered and everything, right? Those really most restrictive burqas with just a little screen pattern where the eyes mm-hmm. go. And one of them says to the other, I would love to live in the West. Being a transvestite here is pointless. And I just think that cartoon, it actually says several things. I mean, it speaks to the kinds of prejudice and bigotry that non-standard people go through. And including all kinds of transgender issues and homosexuality, the whole thing. It speaks a bit to that. Also speaks to the kind of oppression that women go through in certain countries in the Middle East. And it kind of begs the psychological question, would a transvestite in a society like that get any kind of psychological gratification from appearing in public dressed as a woman when no one would know that it was even that person, or they couldn't even see your face? I honestly don't know the answer to these questions. I just think it's an interesting psychological quiz. Like, you know, would it work? Would you bother? Well, of course, you could be killed in a country like that. You could be killed for dressing like the opposite sex. But yeah, I don't know. I just think it's a funny cartoon.
Which is part of the appeal, I think, of Bizarro is that, you know, people can choose to either be amused or offended. And in that particular one, there's several different ranges of people who might have either taken a great laugh or taken umbrage at what you did.
Yeah, I get that a lot. I really do get that a lot because there's just so much humor to be found in pushing boundaries. And all humorists know this, writers, stand-up comics, actors, cartoonist, anybody whose job is humor knows that there's a great deal of humor in pushing the envelope, pushing the boundaries. I don't know, I never do it to be mean is the thing. Like every now and then I've really stepped in it, but it wasn't intentional. It was never to be mean. I can't recall. I remember I used the term tranny one time just to talk about the same topic. Years ago, I did a cartoon, and I used the term tranny, not realizing that just because I'm not so deep in that community that I hear all my friends talking about what offends them. I just didn't realize that was an offensive term. I thought it was just short for transvestite. I just didn't know.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know that was currently a hot button. And the whole PC language movement always is kind of annoying and frustrating to humorists because it handcuffs you. America's kind of become, and yeah, well, America has become we're really building a culture of victims. It seems that there's just way too many people in this country that are just looking for a reason to be offended. And many people are downtrodden. I'm not saying that that the people who are upset don't have very good reason. I'm not saying that they're not a seriously oppressed minority. They most certainly are. But to object to every single mention of an oppressed minority, I think it just takes it too far. There are people, and that's the, I mean, yeah, now I'm starting to sound like a jerk, but what I mean is there are people who understand the difference between an insult and a mention. And that, I think, is where you really draw the lines. If someone, you know, Donald Trump insults minorities, but oftentimes, and so then these various minority groups will rise up and go, that's a terrible thing to say about us. Okay, you're totally right. Donald Trump's a terrible person. What do you expect? But then there are other people who don't understand the difference between an insult and a mention. And to even mention a given minority, they'll throw their hands up and go, that is whatever, racist, sexist, you name it.
Offensive
and
on whatever
level. No, you're wrong. That's just a mention. That's not an insult. There's a difference, you know. So this is what I mean by the culture of victimhood. I think that there are a lot of people are just sort of jumping on the bandwagon and going, yeah, it's fun to be insulted. Let's be insulted by every single mention of our people. Whoever that might be.
A general touchiness. In fact, I read Froma Harrop's column this morning in the paper that was dealing with very much the same thing on college campuses, the idea that that people just get so touchy about mentions or opinions or things like that, that it gets so prickly that people are afraid to say things, which has a chilling effect. We're talking to Dan Peraro.
Yeah.
He is he's the author of the Bizarro comic strip running in something like 360 newspapers across the country. He'll be in Eugene on Sunday for a free appearance on Banned Books Week. It's at 2 o'clock at the Eugene Downtown Public Library. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Dan. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you got strong responses to some of your cartoons. Some of them are obviously highly in praise of them, too. And it seems like your Evolution cartoon from, let's see, it was December of 07, was one that really seemed to get around.
Yeah, that was the one with the ascent of the traditional ascent of man,
mm-hmm.
Artwork, where we have the little fish climbing out of the water and growing legs and turning into a reptile and then turning into a rodent and then turning into like a little primate and then a monkey and then a caveman and then a human. And it's kind of in my cartoon, it's kind of a circular movement. The creatures crawl out of the water, they turn right, they go down the shore a little bit as they evolve. And then the man, the modern man, is dumping a big, huge container of trash right back into the ocean where he came from. So it's entirely, obviously, it's a statement on how we're kind of poising ourselves to be the least successful species that ever lived. I say that because it occurred to me a few years ago, I had been raised to believe, as all of us anthropocentric humans are raised these days, I have been raised to believe that humans were the most successful species ever. We tamed the planet. We rule the planet. We have paved over the planet. We control the planet. We, for thousands of years, have thought the planet was entirely created just for us, and there's many people who still believe that. Meanwhile, by our own hand, we are very close to causing our own extinction, and we will have been the only species in the history of the world that anybody knows of that caused their own extinction out of just pure hubris. And that would make us the least successful species that ever lived, because we really, by world standards, geological standards, we haven't even been around very long. Dinosaurs were around hundreds of times longer than we have been so far. So anyway, that's just one of the issues that, of course, bothers a lot of people these mm-hmm. days. Now that climate change is becoming really obvious, and the deniers are sort of finding ways to backpedal.
On something like this, like Care of the Planet, I'm reminded of what Jon Stewart once said about what it was like to create The Daily Show, and he talked about how they come in the morning and they express their anger, and then they have to find ways to modify that anger over the course of the day into something that'll be funny. Is that a process similar to what you have to go through sometimes?
Yeah, that's the tough thing, is that it's very, and The Daily Show does it so much better than I ever have, but it's very difficult when you're angry about something as a creative person. You go like, yeah, I want to speak to this. And the first thing you end up doing is being preachy. You know, it's like you've got to go through permutations. You've got to figure out a way, how can I do this? And I've been guilty of this many times. I've created cartoons that are they're just a club over the head. They're just way too obvious and preachy. And you know, of course, you preach in the choir in that case. The people that agree with you are like, yeah. And nobody else even notices. And a handful of people who are against it will go, you're an idiot. So, you know, you're not really changing any minds by being preachy. That's something that I've realized over the years as in various kinds of activism. This kind of evangelical preaching just doesn't work. You've got to find another way. The Daily Show is brilliant at that, of course. I have to, when I get, nowadays, in my wisdom, in my age, I have decided that if I can't think of a funny way to do it, I'm just not going to talk about it. So I wait. I wait and see if something comes to me that will make it funny and just kind of point out the problem without making it a club over the head.
Mm-hmm. I notice how patient you are with your audience. We're talking to Dan Peraro, the creator of the Bizarro cartoon in newspapers across the country. He'll be in Eugene on Sunday. The comment section on your website, I mean, people even asked her like, well, I didn't really get the one with the giant scientist topiary. And you explain the joke to them, which is very patient thing for a creator to do. But then you also have people who are like telling you that you will die if you say any more bad things about Donald Trump.
Yeah. Now, I'm always, that's another thing I've learned over the years is that I'm also extremely patient with people who send me hate mail. It doesn't happen that often, but I always try to, when someone writes to me and says, you know, I found this particular cartoon extremely offensive. How dare you, this, that, and the other. My son-in-law, da-da-da-da-da, you know, they give a personal example of how this horrible thing had touched their lives, and here I was making fun of it in a crass way, you know. And I find that if I write back to them and say, I really appreciate your input, and I'm very sorry that you were offended by this. It certainly wasn't my intention. And I do this whether they have a legitimate complaint or they just completely misunderstood my cartoon because they're not very bright. And I get those kinds of letters too, as you will when your work goes out to millions of markets or millions of people, potentially millions of people in hundreds of markets. You're going to get some people that are just not very sharp. And they're going to write and say, I am so offended by what you did here. And they're completely off base. It's not even what the cartoon was about. They've utterly, totally misunderstood. But I always say, I appreciate you telling me about this. It was not my intention by any means to upset you or anybody else in this particular position. What my cartoon was supposed to mean was, and then I say, but I understand how you misunderstood it. And in the future, I'll be more careful about alternative meanings that my cartoons might have. And they invariably absolutely melt. And they say, oh, I didn't even expect a response. Thank you so much. And they just want to be heard. You know, that's really all it is. They just want to feel like their opinion matters.
Right.
And it really works like a charm. It just makes their day. Because they see me as a celebrity, which I'm most certainly not. But they see me because I'm in the newspaper. They think, he must be very important and very rich and very busy, and he's not even going to respond to this. And when I do, they're beside themselves. And it just makes their day. It makes them feel heard. And I think that's a great thing. I, you know, it's certainly no extra effort on my part just to be nice.
They're right about you being very busy. What about the very rich part? I mean, how long had you been doing Bizarro when you felt like you could relax a bit financially? Have you yet?
I'll let you know when that happens.
Right.
Yeah, it was. I've often called it the worst get rich quick scheme I've ever had. I really thought that if I could manage to get syndicated, and I didn't know anything about the business. I started this in the mid '80s. I was syndicated in '85. So when I was the run up, you know, like '82 to '85, those 3 years where I thought I would like to try to get syndicated and become a newspaper cartoonist, the interwebs hadn't even been invented yet. There was no online source of information. Mm-hmm. I went to the library, in fact. The library. Remember? Uh-huh. You remember libraries?
Yeah, course, you'll be at one on Sunday.
That's right. I went to the library and checked out a book, How to Become a Syndicated Cartoonist. And it was all about how to write, draw cartoons and stuff. But it didn't really talk much about the business model. So I didn't know. I just assumed, like, if you get syndicated, they would say, okay, well, we're going to start you off at $195,000 a year, and with health benefits and a retirement plan. I don't know. I was just that stupid. I was just a 20-something-year-old kid, and I had no idea. I just thought that's how the business worked. And so when I got into it, and I realized I was only getting a percentage of the money that newspapers who were willing to run my cartoon paid, it's like I had no idea. My first month of syndication, I had 7 newspapers, and I made like $110 the whole month.
Oh, wow. So your first check was like $100 or something. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought, oh my God, I've just talked my way into another full-time job, and it doesn't pay what the first one does.
Much more to talk about with Dan Peraro, the creator of the Bizarro comic running in newspapers across the country. We'll be back, more to talk with Dan, and take phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dan Peraro, the cartoonist. I mean, you may not know his name, but you certainly might have seen his comic, the Bizarro comic, appearing in something like 360 newspapers across the country. Really twisted take on life. He followed in the footsteps of Gary Larson, in a literal sense, at the same syndicator originally. He's been going at it for 30 years now. He'll be appearing at the Eugene Library on Sunday as part of Banned Books Week. It's the kickoff event at 2 o'clock at the downtown Eugene Public Library. Free. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you'd like to talk to Dan Peraro. 800-838-3760 by phone anywhere in the region, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Trying to figure out the genesis of your viewpoint on it. Sounds like Eastern Oklahoma was kind of bizarro world for you.
Yeah, I was raised, I was born in Kansas City, and my whole family's from Kansas City. But we moved to a small town in northeastern Oklahoma when I was, about 5. I started school there. And I spent all my school days in Oklahoma. We later moved to Tulsa, which was at the time their version of a big city. And so I was raised in Tulsa after that, went to high school there, and a lot of family that still lives there.
And so...
I'll be honest, it still sometimes embarrasses me. For the longest time, I was embarrassed about being from Oklahoma, and rightly so. It really is very backward. And I can say this because I'm from there. But it's a bit like visiting the past. If you want to know what it'd be like to go in a time machine, just go visit Oklahoma, and you'll see what the United States was like in the 1970s. They not only was Oklahoma the only state in the entire country that did not have a single precinct vote for Obama in either of the last two elections. That makes it the most conservative state in the country, which I would not have guessed. I would have thought that would be like Alabama or something. But no, it's Oklahoma. The other thing is, I just read this week, was that a teacher in Oklahoma, a public school teacher in Oklahoma, recently sent a four-year-old child home with a piece of paper explaining to her parents why this teacher was going to attempt to change this child from a left-handed to a right-handed child, because left-handed had traditionally been considered evil. I'm not kidding.
Wow.
That actually happened. That's the kind of backward nonsense you get in a place like Oklahoma. Now, not everybody. I have friends there. I have family there. There are some, this doesn't represent everybody in the state. But it has a lot. I mean, James Inhofe, their senator, is one of the last climate change deniers.
Oh, he's one that says climate change is a hoax, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He thinks the whole thing, he doesn't think it. He just, it's all about having the oil companies in his back pocket and knowing that his constituency is foolish enough to believe him.
Have you ever looked, Dan, at the political cartoonists, the Tom Tolles of the world and the like, and thought, boy, I wish I could do that instead? I mean, could you do something overtly political?
I can't. No, not where I am. And here's why, because when a syndicate sells a cartoon to a newspaper, the newspaper wants to know if it's editorial or humor. If it's editorial, they put it on the editorial page. If it's humor, they put it on the funny pages. And they don't like the two to mix. Doonesbury notwithstanding, Doonesbury is sold as an editorial cartoon with a point of view that belongs on the funny pages. And it's really kind of, you know, that and Mallard Fillmore, I think, is the right-wing version of that. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of but the rest of us, we have to sort of play by the rules. And I can get kind of political. I can do social politics and that sort of thing. But if I start getting, like, literally political and mention specific political characters or whatever, personalities, then yeah, newspapers, they complain because what happens is that their readers start complaining. It's so funny. People will accept any opinion that's on the editorial page, but if it's in the comics page, they get mad. And every now and then, when I do this, I will invariably get a certain amount of hate mail saying, you know, stay out of politics. You're in the funny papers. You know, I don't read Bizarro to get a lesson on what you think about politics. And they're, I'm a liberal guy, so typically a right winger that I'm getting this letter from. So I can't. And the thing is, like, there was years ago, I actually wanted to be a political cartoonist, and I thought that maybe I should have gone that direction mm-hmm. instead, or maybe I should start a sideline and start doing political cartoons. But what I realized is I really don't have a temperament for it. It's just, if I follow politics too closely, I get very depressed and despondent. And I find it to be a really toxic, poisonous, shallow world of egomaniacs. And I have found over the years that my only path to mental health and emotional comfort is to ignore politics. So I just scan the headlines. So I have an idea of what's going on, but I don't read enough about it to be a political cartoonist.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So you don't get too deep into it. We have some calls for you here. Let's go to Ryan and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dan Peraro, the creator of Bizarro in the comics.
Well, good morning, Dan, and thank you, by the way. You give me enlightenment and joy every morning. I'm probably one of the few people who got a master's degree in Gary Larson cartoons.
Really?
One of the things that I love is that what you were just talking about earlier is that sort of multiple-layer processing. You know, I saw Gary give a keynote at the National Science Teachers Association, and he would put a cartoon up on the screen, 10,000 people, scientists in an audience. And you'd hear chuckles from about 3,000, and then you'd hear whisper, 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 and then more chuckles after the joke was explained. And one of the things that I love about your example of the two people in the burqa is that there is that sort of multiple layering of narrative in one panel. I just think this is an awesome talent you have to create that one panel that has basically a narrative that as you explore, there's something fun and transformative that happens. So thank you very much. Thank you very much for your work.
And thanks for your call, Ryan.
Wow, thank you, Ryan. Yeah, I appreciate that. That made my whole day. It makes me feel far more talented and important than I did 3 minutes ago.
Ryan is good for the ego that way, yes. I wonder how you prime the pump, Dan. I mean, how do you get the creative juices going and move on to do the next cartoon and the next cartoon?
That's the good feelings
of 3 minutes ago.
Exactly. Boom, there it goes. You just completely deflated me. You just reminded me of how much work I had ahead of me. People use all kinds of different methods to write cartoons. It's like, that's the question that every syndicated cartoonist gets pretty much, is where do you get your ideas? How can you? Because people follow you for years. It does sort of impress them eventually that, gosh, this is a new idea every single day. How do they do it? I used to do it by flipping through books and magazines, and now I flip through the internet. So it's just a matter of putting a lot of things in front of my eyes until either a picture or a phrase or a situation kind of sparks something, and then my eyes sort of glaze over, and I fall inside of my head, and I think about it for a couple of minutes and turn it around a few different ways, and then I scribble down whatever I come up with. And sometimes it's a good cartoon, sometimes it's just a germ of an idea, and sometimes it's just a complete crap, and I can't do anything with it at all. And I move on.
You've had some fun with existing figures. I noticed, in fact, you mentioned recently on the website about having gone through another Wizard of Oz phase where there were a bunch of Wizard of Oz cartoons. It must be really fun to take these iconic figures and do something different with them, like have the Tin Man having to go through the X-ray belt at the airport because he's not flesh and blood like the others.
Yeah. Yeah, I get a big kick out of it. One of the things I also get a kick out of is that there's certain kind of tropes in the cartoon world. You know, there's certain themes that cartoonists over the decades have returned to again and again and again.
Like the desert island?
The man on the desert island is probably the first one everybody would think of. Of course, as anybody and anything on a psychiatrist's couch. So it's always, and then, of course, there's the beggar on the street corner with a sign. Those things have just been done thousands of times. But while I try to avoid doing things that other people have done, those tropes are fun to return to because it's sort of a way in which, I think it's a way in which cartoonists compete with each other. It's like, hey, here's my version of a desert island cartoon. Is it as funny as some of the greats like Gain Wilson or Charles Adams or Gary Larson or whoever? You know, other people have done this too, and here's my. And so you're sort of competing. You're swimming in the same water with them side by side. It's like, here's my version of this cartoon. What do you think of this, people? So it's sort of a fun little kind of a competitive ego thing to delve in. I did a cartoon about this very thing. It was a Sunday cartoon, so it was one of the big wide screen kind of cartoons, and it was a desert island, and it had one palm tree, and the desert island had about 20 recognizable cartoon characters on it from all kinds of different famous cartoons. And then there's a guy swimming up, and one of the guys on the shore goes, you know, move on to the next island, buddy, this one's full. So it's just something like that. But it's basically the idea that the desert island trope has been hit by every major cartoonist since time began, so this was sort of my version of putting all that together into one image.
Dan, do you sometimes start a cartoon with one idea and then another part of your brain gets a hold of it and just twists it in a whole different direction?
That does occasionally happen. I mean, it's rare that it goes in a whole different direction, but sometimes when I'm partway through it or toward the end, I'll suddenly realize, oh, wait a minute, this would be so much better if the other guy was saying it, you know, or whatever. And like, it's like, you know, I'll get this little click in my head, like, bang, oh, this is a better way to do this. I'm turning this whole thing around. So that does occasionally happen. I wish I could think of an example, but I can't.
All right. We have an email here from Jay in Walterville who writes about cartoons and just a general technological trends. Newspapers going digital, and what's your spin on technology and cartoons, and what it's done to newspapers, for example?
Yeah, well, it's a double-edged sword, to say the least. The great things about the internet is that it has made it's made it much easier for anybody to get their work out in front of the public. And that's a great thing, always a good thing. It's also made research a whole lot easier. A cartoonist like myself used to have a room full of books. And if I wanted to do a cartoon about Napoleon or the Incredible Hulk or whoever, I would have to go through books and books and books until I found a good image, because the way I draw and stuff, you know, I wanted it to be somewhat, I always want things to be somewhat accurate, realistic, etc. So I would have to do a lot of research. Now it's just, you know, Napoleon, tap, 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 done. 450,000 pictures of Napoleon on Google. I can just pick the one I want to go and use that uniform, you know. So that's been a real benefit. It's also a benefit because so many more people see my work, which could potentially lead to so many more people buying my books or T-shirts or whatever products, the kind of things that help support us as the newspaper industry subsides. So, but the downside of it is exactly that newspapers are waning. They're having, you know, and that's where the majority of my income comes from, is newspapers. I've never sold a ton, you know, even cartoon books don't sell as well anymore because people know. It used to be that they follow a cartoon strip. They want to be able to collect all those images in a book so that they can have it. Well, now they know, well, anytime I want any of those images, I can just go on the web. They're everywhere. They're all over the web for free, so they don't buy the books. So that cuts into the income. The newspapers are giving a lot of their, have traditionally been giving away their content online for free. I don't know how they thought that business model was going to work out, but it didn't work out so well. And now they're having to try to charge, but people are already used to getting everything for free on the internet. So it makes it extremely difficult to charge people for content on the internet. People think everything on the internet should be free. To a degree, that's kind of true. Some things, you know, but people got to make a living. So if you want, you know, for someone like me, if the newspaper industry falls far enough and I'm no longer making an income from newspapers, I'll start doing something else. I won't just keep producing Bizarro and putting it online for free every day. I've got a mortgage to pay like everybody else. I got a dog to feed. I got a motorcycle to fill up with gas. So, now one interesting aspect of all this is that, there's a model that I'm going to, I think, going to be working in the next couple of years. I'm going to start doing a long form comic, like comic book, comic strip, graphic novel kind of thing. I'm going to start doing a long form story, a cartoon story on the internet with regular characters, and it'll still have all the same weird humor and social commentary. I'm going to do it on the internet on a subscription service, and people can pay, you know, just like 50 cents a week to see a whole page of this cartoon book, and I'm going to see if I can turn that model into something that's economically viable.
All right, we look forward to seeing that. We certainly look forward to seeing Bizarro in the paper every morning. Dan Peraro is the cartoonist of Bizarro. He'll be at the Eugene Library 2 o'clock on Sunday to kick off Banned Books Week. Thanks so much for joining us, Dan.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, take care.